Are we five?
You five now. Yes, you five. It's still short.
Of one member?
Yes, sir.
Noxie, where are you?
She is on the platform.
Honorable Abraham.
I can see that she's on the platform. I'm not sure. Maybe she can't hear, but she is on the
platform. I'm here. I'm just struggling to unmute. Thank you so much. Good morning, Chair. Good morning, everybody. Claro and Kangel.
Yeah, how is the amount of ANC by joining? We are not correcting them.
I will do that now, Chair. Sure.
Tebo, I think we're correct. I see Honorable Surupen has joined.
Yes, now we do have a quorum, sir.
Okay, we'll have to, let's start with our meeting.
Recording in progress.
Good morning, honorable members of National Assembly and committee members. I'm not sure if the deputy minister is in the platform. He's welcome. Let me also welcome the governor of the Reserve Bank, deputy governors, and the entire management of the Reserve Bank and the Prudential Authority. Welcome all support team members from Parliament who support this committee. Welcome the media, other stakeholders who are in attendance, and the public. The meeting is officially open. Let's get the roll call and apologies. Do we have apologies?
I didn't receive any apologies, sir.
Okay. Okay, let's proceed to item 3, where we'll get a briefing by the South African Reserve Bank and the Prudential Authority on their annual report. Honorable Bushwambo, are you raising your hand?
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Yes, I am raising my hand there. And I thought that before you say that the South African Reserve Bank must make a presentation, you're going to call for the adoption of the agenda so that we can raise an issue. We have written a letter to the South African Reserve Bank on the 28th of June 2022, asking specific questions about the evidence, prima facie evidence that was produced on Phalaphala Farm. And we asked the South African Reserve Bank to confirm or deny if they have ever interacted with declarations from the sitting president about the millions of US dollars that were stored in Phalaphala. And we also asked if, as the institution that is responsible for foreign currency regulations, what has happened? And the Reserve Bank has not answered to that question. And it is their obligation constitutionally to be accountable to Parliament and to members of Parliament and to the people of South Africa. And the Reserve Bank has not given a specific response on an issue which is of public interest, which is about accountability. So I don't think that before they respond to that question, they must be permitted to present anything here in the committee. So let us be given a response first, unless if they are part of the crimes that are being committed in this country or wrong money movements. So can we be given an account first of what has the Reserve Bank done about the thus far undenied, undisputed foreign currency regulations violations by the sitting president, because they are an institution that is primarily responsible for that. Can we get that accountability before they make any presentation about the annual report and everything else there of the Prudential Authority and everything else? Can we be given an account of just what happened with the money movements? Because we have never been given an opportunity to could interact with them. We wrote letters, we wrote parliamentary questions. We even wrote letters saying that we're going to take them to court, but still they obdurately refused to respond to our questions. Can we be given a response before we club them with Ramaphosa and the stealing of people's money? Please.
Okay, Honorable Shibambu, so you wrote a letter to the Reserve Bank. Let's get the response from the governor as to how are they attending to the letter that you have written to them, so that we can proceed and see how they will want the matter to be processed. Governor, there is that request from Honorable Shibambu about their correspondence to you and the matter that he has raised. Will it be covered in your presentation, or how will you want it to be processed?
Well, we will take your guidance. We do not have it covered in the presentation. We understood that we would be presenting our annual report here. We did respond to the letter, by the way, and it was not just a letter that had come from Honorable Shibambu. It was a letter from a number of political parties, and the response was exactly the same. Once we get any report of any possible violations of foreign exchange control regulations, we engage with the particular party. When I say party, I mean whether it is an individual or a company. And it is practice that we do not comment on any of our investigations because we do not want to undermine the investigation. We are cooperating, we are working with the law enforcement authorities on this, and I do not think that it would serve us any good trying to get into the details of what is going on. It would undermine the investigations that we are doing.
Have you responded to the letter from the EFF?
Yes, we did.
Chairperson, can we quickly intervene here? Because I think the governor of the Reserve Bank is taking us for granted here. He's reducing Parliament to some media request for a comment. We're not asking for your comment. We're asking you for accountability as an institution that must enforce foreign currency regulations. We're not asking for a comment from you. We're asking you to confirm if you are doing anything about the violation of the foreign currency regulations. We're not asking for a comment from you. We're not a media house. We are elected by the people of South Africa to hold the executive and yourselves accountable. We're not asking for a comment from you. We're asking you to perform your obligations. Did you do anything about a prima facie violation of foreign currency regulations? That is what you must be responding to. We're not asking for a comment from you. We're asking for accountability. You have got an obligation. It doesn't matter how you feel personally, whether you want to protect the sitting president or not, but you have got an obligation to respond to Parliament truthfully if you are doing something or not. That is what I'm looking for. And you must respond to that here before you present anything in terms of what is required from the Federal Reserve Bank. That is what we're waiting for now.
Honorable Shwam, have you received the response from the Reserve Bank? Has the governor saying that he responded?
Chair, what the letter from the Reserve Bank said is that we have got no comment. He treated that as if it were a media inquiry. We are asking for a comment from the Reserve Bank. That is not a response. It was a refusal to respond to the specific questions. The specific questions were asking for accountability. What the Reserve Bank governor said was that he doesn't have a comment. And what kind of nonsense is that? What kind of nonsense is that when you treat members of parliament and parliamentary processes as if you are treating the media? We're not asking for a comment from the Reserve Bank. We're asking for accountability. And it is constitutionally enshrined that all these institutions must account to parliament. And accountability, where have you ever seen that? You just say you do not have any comment. Where does that come from? And if that is permitted, it means that in all other instances, when we want to hold the executive and institutions of government or that are established by the Constitution accountable, we're going to be told no comment because we're dealing with a different process. Where in the law, where in the parliamentary regulations, where in the rules of the National Assembly of any other institutions of accountability does it say that an institution can say no comment based on this? Even the prima facie, even the sub judice rule of parliament does not permit that. There is no case that is before a court of law that relates to Palapara currently. And there is no reason, none whatsoever, that the Reserve Bank cannot confirm or deny if it is investigating the matter of Palapara, because it's an issue of public interest that they must have to respond to. So there is nothing at all that prevents the Reserve Bank from answering to the questions that we have written to them. The letter which they have sent back to us was to say no comment, as if they are responding to a media house, to Daily Sun. We are not Daily Sun. We are a parliamentary body. We are a parliamentary institution that has got the obligation to ask questions and deserve the right to be responded to. So we want the response before we proceed with this process now.
Okay, Honorable Shwambu, let me also allow other members to comment. Honorable George, Honorable Abraham, Honorable Mrolong.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would also confirm that the DEA did also write to the Reserve Bank regarding the matter, and that we did receive a reply. Mindful also of the fact that there are several processes, etc., in a fairly complex matter. So we did receive the response with thanks, and our view would be that we do have business today to get on with. There are lots of issues in our economy that need to be attended to in terms of monetary policy, et cetera, and various other risk factors. So we would prefer that this meeting would continue with its business and not get sidetracked by this matter at this point. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thanks, Dr. George. Honorable Abram.
Okay, Chair. I think, Chair, the matter that is being raised by Honorable Shivambu is a matter of interest to all of us. And I think the reason why you allowed it is because as the committee, we do have an interest in the Reserve Bank response. But listening to the response of the Reserve Bank, I think in all fairness, what we need to do, Chair, is to arrange a special meeting, which should be probably an urgent meeting with that item only, so that we can interact with it vigorously. I listened to the governor as he was beginning to respond that, yes, he needs guidance from you as chairperson. However, the matter is not part of what they are here to present today. As much as we are indeed looking for answers,
we also do not want half-baked answers. In all honesty, what we need to do is to give the Reserve Bank an opportunity to prepare for this so that it becomes part of the agenda. Because, I mean, in all fairness, if now we are refusing to listen to other items because they are not answering to this one, nothing will back us because this is not part of the agenda. So respectfully, Chair, I think let us give that opportunity to them to prepare thoroughly for us so that we also are satisfied with the responses. Or if we are not, then we take them to task because we gave them an opportunity and gave them an agenda for the meeting constitutionally. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Honorable Abram. Honorable Mrolo.
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson. I too concur with Honorable Abrams that we need to set aside a date on which the governor will respond to the questions that have been posed by several members so that the response is comprehensive and qualitative. And we do not just get responses that have not been properly processed. I'm of the view that we should set aside a day so that these matters can be threshed out. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Honorable Bushbambo, your colleagues, do you think that the matter be taken back to Reserve Bank to respond adequately and then make sure that we take the matter forward as the committee? Because for now, they will not be prepared. But I think this suggestion that is coming with Honorable Abraham and seconded by Honorable Mrolo comes with a middle ground which can take us forward. Honorable Shuam.
Chairperson, there has not been any sound and balanced reason that has been given by the Reserve Bank as to why they're not responding to the question, because there's no subject to K case. There's no case before a court of law. The rules of the National Assembly are very clear in terms of issues that cannot be entertained in Parliament. It's issues that are currently under adjudication in a court of law. There's absolutely nothing before the court of law now. The Reserve Bank is obliged to respond. I don't think that there's anything difficult. They know, they've got their system. They know who declares foreign currency when it comes into countenance. They must have to respond as to did they receive any declaration of any foreign currency that is alleged to be in the president's farm. And if they do. If they don't, they don't. What is complex about that? They must respond to that question because it's not sub judice. They must just confirm they know that there was declaration on this date, there was no declaration on this date. What is difficult about that? What investigation do you have to make for what is from 22nd of June up until now? It's August now. How much more time do you need to just declare it if someone has declared a man which came to the counter or not? What is difficult about that? Unless if they're part of a cover-up to try to hide the information that we need to be accounted for here in Parliament. So that is one issue that is quite obvious. We must not be taken for the ride. We are not fools. We are not children. We must be given proper responses by the institutions that account to us, and the response must be given. Maybe if we say we must be given a different day, let's say tomorrow. Let's convene a special meeting tomorrow to get a response. They must just go to their foreign currency records to check if there is a declaration by president, then we then know what is happening, because we cannot be held at ransom and not be given answers by a Reserve Bank which is supposed to be accounting to Parliament. So let us get that response as urgent as possible. It was supposed to be given a long time ago, but they are here now, they must give it to us, because they know whether there was declaration or not. It's not an issue that requires any further investigation. It's not an issue that requires an investigation at all. So let us be given a response so that we know what is happening. Please, Chairperson.
Okay, thanks, Honorable Bushbambo. Governor and your team, that's it. Honorable members of Parliament, recommend that the Reserve Bank attends to this matter and come back to the committee with the adequate response. So we'll have to make a follow-up with you, with our support team here, as to when will you be ready. Can we proceed to the next item with that understanding? Okay. Let's proceed to the next item. Governor, and your
Chairperson, can we please get an indication from the Reserve Bank as to when are they just going to go into their records of people who and institutions who record the bringing of money into the country, and then they tell us if the sitting president has brought their attention that the foreign currency that was brought to the country or not. But what is difficult about that? Because this information is not a personal information. It's not a personal information that you can say, no, I'll disclose this and when I want to do so. This is a public institution. It does not belong to anyone. There's no one. They are just occupying those roles for a temporary moment. They have got an obligation as to law to account to us. So they must tell us whether there was declaration or not, so that we know whether. And then they must then tell us if they can't do it today, let it do it tomorrow.
Okay, Honorable Bushbam. I think what we are saying is that all the issues that you have raised in the letter, the Reserve Bank will have to attend to them and indicate as to when will they be ready to come back with that response. So they will have to respond to all those issues. You are a member of parliament. You represent your constituency, which has got an interest in the matter, and the Reserve Bank account to parliament. So they will have to do so. I don't have to go down and read the rules of parliament as to if there is an institution like Reserve Bank, how does it go about accounting? They know how they are supposed to account. And I believe that, as we have said, they will be in the best position to respond to all the issues that you have raised. And I think also, if Dr. George is satisfied with the response, fine. If he's not, they will also have to adequately respond to the issues raised by Dr. George and his party. If there are difficulties, the Reserve Bank should indicate to us as to where are the difficulties, and then we take it from there. So our support team here, I see Advocate Frank Jenkins is here and the Secretariat. They will make sure that they follow up with the Reserve Bank now that the matter has been raised here in the committee. So can we move forward with that understanding? Thanks. Reserve Bank Governor, over to you with the report.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks for the invitation to share our views on the South African economy, developments in financial stability and monetary policy, and also highlight the annual report of the South African Reserve Bank and that of the Prudential Authority. Just to restate, and we'll not spend a lot of time on this because this is familiar territory for the committee, that our primary mandate, that of protecting the value and of the currency in the interest of balance and sustainable economic growth.
On a point of order, Chairperson.
Okay, wait, Governor. Honorable Bushbam.
Can you please get an indication from the Reserve Bank as to when are they going to respond to the question? Because we can't leave this thing open-ended. Let's please get an indication, and then they will present the report. Can you give us an indication as to when are they going to respond to the questions about the foreign currency that was brought into the country? Was it brought? When are they going to do it? If they can't do it today, when are they going to do it? Let's get that so that we have got some certainty that we've got a credible institution that is accountable to Parliament. Please.
I think Honorable Shwambu...
Well, you can't sweep it under the carpet.
Yes, Honorable Shwambu, I thought we are agreeing that the support team of the committee, after this meeting, will make sure that they follow up with the Reserve Bank to make sure that the issues that you have raised are attended to, so that it's not just you as Honorable Shwambu or EFF. Now that you have officially raised it here in the committee, it is upon the committee support team to make a follow-up and come back to us as soon as possible. I thought that will assist us to take us forward. So there's no way that they will not respond to those issues, because they've got the responsibility to account to Parliament. So we'll make sure that they respond to the issues that you have raised adequately and come back as soon as possible, or within what we call a reasonable time. Can we move forward, Honorable Shwambu, with that?
What is a reasonable time, Chairperson?
As soon as possible, they will come back.
But what is it as soon as possible? Because said as soon as possible can be a year, to some people it can be 2 hours, it can be anything. What is as soon as possible? We always do that in Parliament. Whenever we ask for response, we always give timelines. Can we at least agree on a timeline as to when are we going to get the exact responses?
Okay. Advocate Jenkins, can you advise in a matter of as soon as possible or within reasonable time?
Good morning, Chairperson, Honourable Members, and the official from the Reserve Bank. Chair, in fact, what you said, reasonable time is as soon as possible. So, I mean, well, what we can do, Chair, is through the committee secretary as well, and even the Reserve Bank can even reply now. We need a time as soon as possible, Chairperson. Given the content of the request from the Economic Freedom Fighters, Honourable Shwambu, to say when can they brief the committee on what is happening with this matter, seeing that it has happened more than 8 weeks ago and there's considerable interest in it, Chair. So even for obligations, there's an oversight of, obligation of Parliament, so we need to do it as soon as possible, Chair. So maybe Reserve Bank can give us indication when they're ready to brief. And then the other thing is the committee's program. When can we hear this briefing, Chairperson? That's as much as I can say for now. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. Thanks, Advocate Jenkins. Can we move forward, Honorable Shwambu, with that understanding? Please.
No, I thought that Advocate Jenkins had said that the Reserve Bank must tell us when are they ready to give us the response. Can we get the exact date, please?
Okay. Reserve Bank, the response within a reasonable time, as soon as possible. How long do you think this matter can take for you to respond to the issues raised by members of this committee? Back to the governor.
Honorable Chairperson, I would not be able to give a time at this stage. We are doing investigations. And those questions that are being asked require us to complete our investigations in order to be able to respond to that. We'll have to go back to the legal team that is doing the investigations in the sub and revert back to the committee. I thought, Chair, your ruling when you said that the support staff of Parliament will speak with the support staff of the Reserve Bank so that we can reach a reasonable understanding of the time period that will be required was what we were comfortable with. And but I will take your guidance on this, sir.
Okay. Honorable Abraham? Noxie, are you raising your hand?
Yes, Chair. Sorry, I've got muting problems again. No, Chair, I was going to say that I think as the Parliament takes the matter forward, there should be a letter that comes from us. They should also be writing that letter on behalf of the committee, because so far there are letters that are coming from parties And I think in the letter, Parliament, through the committee functionaries, should indicate the time frame. I do not think the expectation of the members is that we have a complete picture of what is to happen in the future or anything. I think all that needs to happen is for the Reserve Bank to be able to account for what has happened so far. So I think the interaction between the committees should result in a letter where even Advocate Jenkins will assist with its kind of constitution, so that it is a legally correct letter that talks to the timing. And I agree also with Honorable Shivambo that it doesn't have to be a long time, because this is a matter that is in progress, and we are not expecting that some closure has been reached on it. And therefore, all that needs to happen is accounting on what has already happened. And I think in the process of doing that, the committee officials should also get the letter from the EFF as well as the letter from the DA, so that we can be able to formulate a common content in terms of what we need as a committee, and in that letter stipulate the time frame. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thanks very much. Can we take the matter forward with that understanding that there be a coordination between the Parliament support team and sub team to work on this matter. I think it's a matter that needs lots of details and be scientific with information, so that whatever comes back as a product to this committee is something that is well informed. So I think if we can agree, as it has been suggested, that let the parliamentary support team and the sub team work on this matter, and as soon as possible come back to Parliament. So Advocate Jenkins, Alan and Tebuho, you'll get those letters from EFF, DA and other parties, and then you consolidate them, and then put together a letter to SAB that these are the issues that are being raised by honorable members of Parliament, and can SAB respond to those issues to Parliament through this committee as soon as possible. Can we do that? Thanks. Can we proceed with that understanding, Honorable Shibama, that the parliamentary team from here will consolidate all those letters that you have written and package those issues, resend them to SAB, and then they attend to all those issues, because I think some of the issues that you have raised are substantial. They need a lot of work in terms of getting relevant information, so that whatever they bring back here should be substantial, as I think you have raised quite a number of issues. I haven't seen your letter. I don't want to lie or presume that I've seen it. But I think the issues that you have raised are quite detailed and need a detailed response. But the commitment is that they are ready to bring back the report to this committee and to yourself, of course. As an honorable member, we have raised this issue, and honorable Dr. George.
Can we at least agree that there are certain things which do not really need an investigation? To know if someone has declared foreign currency into the country does not need a very long investigation. Let's agree that it must not take more than 7 days. Like, there must be a meeting where the Reserve Bank comes back here to confirm or to say or deny that there was foreign currency that was declared by the sitting president. Can we be given a specific date? We can say, because we can't live here with an open-ended process where we do not know when it's going to come, because we're most likely going to be trapped into this, what appears not to be a cover-up by the Reserve Bank as well. Let's be given a specific date so that we know as to when are we going to be given the requisite and necessary constitutionally obligatory response as to whether there was declaration of foreign currency that was brought into the country or not. The Reserve Bank has got an obligation to do so. This institution does not belong to them as individuals. It is our institution, it's the institution of the people of South Africa. It doesn't belong to anyone who is occupying the office temporarily now. And that is one thing, because the other option which we have and can have huge implications is to force them through the courts to respond to this question. And we do not want to do that. Because if we take the court option, we're going to demand that the cost of the legal processes must be taken to them as individuals. They must pay the legal cost, because it's not necessary to just avoid the question because they're trying to cover up for a sitting president. It's unethical, it's wrong, it's unacceptable. So let's give them at least a week. We must agree that by next week, Wednesday, we must have been given proper responses on issues that relate to the Reserve Bank. Then we can move it from there, not without a date of when they're going to respond to the questions. Because if we leave it open-ended, they're going to do those things of no comment as if they're responding to media. We're not media. We're members of parliament.
Okay. Honorable Shibambu, I think for now the matter should be treated by parliament. Let's not rush to courts as if, as this arm of government, we can't deal with these issues. Because you have raised this matter, and you are suggesting that they respond within 7 days. And if ever there are challenges, they will indicate that they are still dealing with those issues. But that's what you are recommending. Let's take it back to them. I think they are here. They understand the urgency of the matter, and they will take it up in that manner. Okay. With that understanding, let's proceed then to the main item of the meeting. Governor and your team, can you put the screen, the presentation here on the screen about the annual report?
I was asked by Parliament to unshare, so I must go back and try and share afresh. Hopefully you can see it now.
Yeah, we can see it. You can proceed then with the presentation.
I was saying, Chair, that the primary mandate as enshrined in the Constitution is the protection of the value of the currency in the interest of balanced and sustainable economic growth. The Financial Sector Regulation Act of 2017 also prescribed that the Reserve Bank should protect and enhance financial stability. In executing our mandate, we act independently and without fear, favor, or prejudice in the interest of the economic well-being of all South Africans. Our key functions involve formulating and implementing monetary policy, which is really the primary responsibility in order to execute our price stability mandate, promoting the financial stability, which includes acting as a lender of last resort in exceptional circumstances. We do compile economic statistics and conduct analysis and research. We act as a banker to the government. And more importantly is that we ensure the effective functioning of the national payment system. It is probably one of our most important functions because it is the backbone that enables South Africans to transact, to send and receive money through the banking system. We also administer the country's prudential and capital flow measures, which are in the main cross-border flows. We regulate and supervise financial institutions, which include banks, insurance entities, and financial market infrastructures. And we also manage the country's official gold and foreign exchange reserves. And lastly, we issue and destroy banknotes and coins. We are the only entity in the country that is allowed to issue banknotes and coins, and no one is allowed to destroy them other than the South African Reserve Bank. With that background, let me turn to the macroeconomic outlook. And in summary, say that we have seen sharply higher global inflation and slower growth. There are very few exceptions in terms of countries that are not experiencing higher inflation. Inflation is on the rise and eroding the incomes of working people. And we have also seen that central banks across the world have responded more forcefully with monetary policy tightening. On the domestic front, growth is expected to slow sharply in the near term on account of the KZN floods, load shedding, and the impact of the tightening of global financial conditions and the slowdown of the global economy. Headline inflation, which is a measure that we target in South Africa, had markedly risen on account of food, fuel, and also core inflation. The rising core inflation is what concerns us because it means that you are starting to see a broader rise in prices. So with core inflation rising, we're seeing the second round effects are starting to manifest themselves, and the risks to the inflation outlook are tilted to the upside. Global growth is projected to slow, and we are also seeing rising recession risks. The green bar on the left there shows the projected world growth in realized growth in 2021, and the blue bar is emerging markets and developing economies. They had risen slightly faster than world growth. And on the second chart, the fainted green and blue, that is the forecast for 2022. And you can see that growth globally has slowed down significantly, and world is expected to grow by 3.2%, while emerging markets and developing economies are expected to grow by 3.6%. Going into 2023, it's expected that the world economy will slow down further to 2.9%, and emerging markets and developing economies, though, will slightly tick up from the 3.6% projected this year to 3.9% in the following year. As I said, inflation has risen sharply and may be nearing its peak, but the return to target likely to be sluggish. The panel on the left is inflation in the advanced market economies. The red line there is inflation in the US, and you could see it continues to climb. And the call is whether this is nearing the peak, and then after that, it will begin to slow down. The yellow line is inflation in the United Kingdom, which is also a very important trading partner for us. You can see the inflation there has risen faster than in the US, and is only expected to peak much later, sometimes either towards the end of this year or the beginning of the new year. The blue line is the Eurozone, which is also a very important trading partner for South Africa. There we are also seeing inflation rising significantly, and is expected to peak towards the end of this year. The exception is Japan. Japan had suffered years of deflation, and you could see that inflation started to pick up in Japan, but it is expected that Japan will remain within the 2% target that they have. All the advanced economies are expected to be outside of their target. And with that expectation of them being outside of their target, there are concerns that inflation expectations could be de-anchored, and we are seeing a global public that is increasingly intolerant of inflation. And in many other parts of the world, we've actually seen the public rising and complaining about rising inflation, and central banks are thus starting to act aggressively to cap the ravages of inflation. And if they are successful, it's expected that we will begin to see the decline into the 2023. And many of the advanced economies are expected to only be back within target either towards the end of 2023 or early in 2024. On the right are the countries that are comparable to South Africa, emerging markets. The blue line here is India, and the emerging markets are expected to peak almost slightly lower depending on which one you are looking at. The exception here being Poland, where it's expected that inflation will continue to rise significantly. Brazil will be picking up just over 10%. Mexico is expected to peak at around just short of the 8% mark. And then South Africa, we expect that we would actually be averaging this year 6.5. But as I said, there are still risks to that outlook. And as such, the Reserve Bank continues to watch that closely. Like we have seen with the advanced economies on the right, on the left, on the right, what we are seeing are the emerging markets, and we can see that even with the emerging markets, it's expected that inflation will begin to slow down in the new year. In the advanced economies, the exception in terms of inflation remaining low is Japan. In the emerging market space, the exception here is China, which is where they expect that inflation will peak at around 2% and that they do not expect it to rise any further than that. And that has given the People's Bank of China an opportunity to adjust their policy rate lower. So that is what you see as inflation rises and rises higher, interest rates go higher, and the countries that are having low inflation are able to maintain their policy rates lower for longer. The screen had frozen because somebody had entered the room here.
Are you co-sharing with the book?
I will do this.
Can you intervene from your side?
Let me see. I'll have to see. Tebogo, can I unshare and then you try and share that side?
I am getting cut off.
You might
that
get
cut
off.
That's why I gave you the co-host.
Okay,
line.
That is fine.
Yes.
That is fine. Let me do this and see what then happens here. Okay, so that is the inflation picture, as I had said, in the emerging market world. This has required more forceful monetary policy tightening. On the left are the advanced economy central bank policy rate changes, and they had actually been pretty aggressive. The changes, the yellow bars reflect changes since February 2021. And you can see across the universe that everybody is raising rates. But if you look at the rates in 2020 and 2021, that is when everybody was cutting rates. And it's the same in emerging markets universe, and South Africa was no exception. You saw that in that period between 20 and February 2021, we were cutting rates, that is that green bar, and starting in November, we also started to adjust our policy rates higher. So you can see that what you is taking place here with respect to monetary policy, the tightening of policy rates across the universe, whether you are in advanced economies or in developing economies. On the fiscal side, it's expected that fiscal policy would remain accommodative in emerging market economies, whilst the twin deficits in those emerging markets might still be persisting in other emerging market economies. And what you are seeing here are various countries. On the left, on the vertical bar, we are measuring vertical axis, we are measuring the current account balance, and on the horizontal axis, we are measuring the fiscal account account balances. So where are we seeing South Africa? We are seeing South Africa almost on a neutral position. Yes, fiscal policy remains accommodative with deficits of just over 6%, but we expect that the current account balance in 2023 will almost reverse to balance. At the moment, we are running a current account a surplus thanks to the commodity price boom. But economies that are in trouble would mainly be the economies in this space where they have got high fiscal deficits and are also having high current account deficits. And that puts them into what we call the twin deficit problem. But we are at the moment in that space. We are in a better position than the others. We shouldn't lie on our laurels, and we should continue to be vigilant and make sure that our policies are consistent with the state of the economy. Commodity prices are beginning to pull back on global growth concerns, and that is why we have it would be eroded, because it has not been driven by volume. It has been very much driven by prices. And the panel on your left shows the index of commodity prices of South Africa. The green line excludes gold, and the red line is the one that includes gold. And what you can see is that we peaked.
But there's not Chairperson, there's no presentation on the screen here.
I think
there's no green. Okay. There are no green lines and columns which have been spoken about here.
Okay, Tebogo.
Just one moment.
Okay, wait. Zuti, are you able to co-host? Busha, are you there? There seems to be a problem. Who else is here from the side of Parliament? I think because Tebogo has a problem with connectivity. I thought Beauty is here in the platform. Antonia, can you intervene? Antonia, can you hear me? Hey, we seem to have problem with the support team. Who else is in the platform?
Chairperson, I'm here. I can try and assist.
Okay, try to assist the advocate, Jenkins. Okay, there we are.
Sir, can you see it now?
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much. So the red line is the commodity price index, including gold. The green line is excluding gold. You can see it peaked in 2021, came down, and rose again in 2022. But already by June this year, we reached the peak, and you see that commodity prices have started to adjust downwards. With respect to the changes of the individual commodities, what you are seeing there on the right, we have seen that by July 2022, iron ore was like down 13%, about just over 20%. So this is the weighting of each one of the commodities in our index. Platinum, so you can see across all the major commodities, things are down. The exceptions have been manganese, oil, and coal. And coal have been basically driven by the war in between Russia and the Ukraine. And as people are looking for alternative energies, they started burning coal again. With the terms of trade and current account situation, we expect that that would moderate further as a result of the decline in those commodity prices. And the left panel here shows the terms of trade. The solid blue line is the terms of trade as of our most recent meeting, which is the July meeting. The dotted line is the commodity prices in May, and you can see once again the terms of trade have actually come down. The current account and the components thereof as a percentage of GDP, and you could see that from 2020 throughout, net exports for South Africa had remained positive. They have been the key driver of the current account balance. And into 2023, we can see that we expect that that net exports will then begin to decline. The other components of the current account deficit, current account balance had remained in deficit. These are net factor receipts and net current current transfers. And the solid line there is what I was talking about earlier. We have been running a current account surplus. That current account surplus will continue to decline, and we expect that it will go into deficit by 2024. You know, Chairperson, there is a technical problem. Every time a new person enters the room, it freezes my presentation. So I end up having to stop sharing and resharing again. I don't know if you should be closing the people coming in. I don't know how that would help, but that is the situation now that I am faced with. I have seen that every time somebody enters the room, I get frozen again.
Advocate Jenkins, are you able to co-host?
If I can get sharing rights, Chairperson, I can share.
Governor, can you share with Advocate Jenkins? Okay. Yeah. The screen is back.
Okay, the screen is back, Chairperson. No, it's gone.
It's gone.
Yes, I just have to get back, reopen the presentation so that there we go.
There. No, down.
Okay. Next slide. Next slide. There. No, go back. Back, you're going to the front. Yeah, this is where we are. So
okay,
we are having the change in commodity prices. That is what we have just dealt with, and I said that there had been a big driver by coal. Next slide, please. And I talked about the terms of trade, and that the terms of trade are deteriorating. With the terms of trade deteriorating, the current account balance is also going to come down. Next slide, please. And there are less favorable global conditions. And with less favorable global conditions, it means that there is a higher risk premium and funding costs. The panel on the left shows South Africa's risk premium. The risk premium basically here is the extra compensation that international investors would demand of South Africa relative to the advanced economies. We saw that it peaked at the height of COVID in 2020. It came down in 2021 as the commodity prices recovered, but it also started to tick up during the course of this year as global financial conditions were being tightened. And at our July meeting, that blue solid line on the left reflects our take of what the country's risk premium is. And if you compare it to the May MPC, which is the dotted black line, you will see that it has actually gone up. On the right side of that same slide, the blue line is the yield curve of South Africa. The yield curve is basically the term structure. It reflects the different levels of interest rates at which the South African government is able to borrow over different periods of time. As you can see, the longer we borrow, the more we end up paying, and we then say that the South African yield curve is steep, and it has actually risen across since the last MPC in July, and actually it has also risen relative to a year ago, which basically means that government will be paying more for the borrowing that it is doing. Next slide, please. 2 years later, it is only then that we saw GDP in South Africa back above the 2011 level. Had it not been for the KZN flood and the July riots last year, we actually think that we would have bounced back to 2019 levels earlier than we had actually did. But now we have bounced back. Next slide, please. But even with this recovery, the bounce back, the recovery has been uneven, and there is possibility that there is scarring, permanent scarring in the more labor-intensive sectors. So the first panel, which shows the developments in the primary sector, and you could see that the primary sector had had but the rebound had been driven in the main by agriculture, and that if you strip out mining, you will actually see that mining is still below the 2019 level. It did get there in 2021 in the second quarter and third quarter and so, but it had been on the decline since then. And part of it is also reflective of the fact that there has been a correction in commodity prices. The second panel reflects the secondary sector. And here we can see that the secondary sector is struggling to bounce back to the levels of 2019. Whether you are looking at electricity or you are looking at manufacturing, but I think even more worrying is what is happening with the black line in that middle panel, which is the construction sector. The construction sector is in the doldrums, and this is a sector that is crucial for the rollout of infrastructure. The right panel is the tertiary sector. The tertiary sector has been the one that has really sort of like carried the activity. Both finance and community sectors have long recovered beyond the 2019 levels, and trade and transport are not that far behind, with trade being
what happened to the sound? Advocate Jenkins, is it my problem this side that I can't hear the governor?
No, Chair, I was also having some anxiety. It seems that it's the governor, not us. It looks like you'll probably have to log on again. I'll stick with the slide, but I he's frozen on my side, Chairperson.
Governor, have you muted or what's happening? Is he still here in the platform? I I can't see him here. Who's assisting the governor here in the platform from his side? Deputy Governor Chasbana and Pile, where are you?
The governor
is just logging off and on again.
He's logging in again.
Kuben, what is the problem with
The governor is just logging off and on again. Just give him 30 seconds if you don't mind.
Who's assisting him from his side? Where are the
IT people are there. We don't know what happened, but he just got kicked out. He'll be back in a few seconds, Chair.
Okay. Can you check with them?
Yeah, we're checking, Chair.
Okay.
Chair, with your permission, should I? Can I continue? Who's sharing? Is it the governor or is it Advocate Jenkins?
Yeah, I'm co-sharing, Mr. Naidu.
Okay. Should we move to the next slide? That would be slide 17.
Okay, Naidu, proceed.
Thanks, Chair. The key point on this slide is that our expectation is that Q2 GDP would have contracted. There were three reasons for that, the mining strike, increased intensity of load shedding, and the floods that we experienced, and the port disruptions as a result of the floods. So we're likely to get a negative Q2. Chair, going forward, we're expecting positive growth, but as you can see from the graph, very low positive growth. Potential GDP is still weak. It's while nominal or real GDP has reached pre-COVID levels, the structure of the economy has not changed much. We still see very weak potential GDP of less than 1%, Chair. Slide 18 deals with those factors. Essentially, what's shown there is the intensity of load shedding. Now, if you look at the left-hand panel, you see that yellow line is the cumulative number of days of load shedding, and it's been going up, Chair, 2018, 2019, 2020, 2021, and that's notwithstanding the fact that the economy was pretty weak in 2020. We still had a significant amount of load shedding, but 2022 so far has broken all the records. So far, I think we've had 37 days of load shedding, if my numbers are correct, Chair. That has a direct impact on GDP, and we've illustrated or estimated the direct impact of load shedding on the left, on the right-hand panel, Chair. So this time we think that just the increased intensity of load shedding in the second quarter would have taken 0.3% off the 2022 GDP. Thanks. Slide 19. Chair, business confidence is still weak for several factors, the load shedding being only one of those factors. But what's also clear, capital formation. And while it's recovered since the COVID trough, it's been on a fairly long downward trend for about 8 to 10 years, Chair. And it's gone up in the last year, but not sustainably. And we don't think it's broken that long downward trend. Chair, slide 20 shows the private investment. And I pointed out that the key factor that drives private fixed investment is business confidence. I showed you business confidence on the previous page. So what is reflected there is the level of fixed capital formation. It's down from, if 100 is the base year, it's down from 100 in all three major categories, but most significantly public corporations. Public corporations' fixed investment continues to be weak. In some ways, that's a legacy of the state capture period, where significant destruction of capacity was seen in public enterprises. The savings decomposition on the right-hand side, so corporate savings continues to drive national savings, offset by a significant increase in government dis-savings. So, Chair, if that's negative, then that's government dis-savings. On balance, we do have a positive current account balance, but Chair, that's not likely to persist for a long time. It is likely that we will revert to a current account deficit again going forward, increasing the vulnerability given our low savings rate. Slide 21 talks about employment and earnings. What's shown there is that GDP may have recovered, but employment is not. We are still somewhere between 3 and 5% below pre-COVID employment levels, and that has disproportionately affected low-skilled workers. Just to give you the headline numbers, if I include informal workers, pre-COVID, that number was just about 16 million. It went to a trough of about 14.6. It's back up at about 15.3, 15.4 million. So still about 3 to 5% below the pre-COVID level. And again, that has disproportionately affected low-skilled people. Chair, on the right-hand side, we saw salaries and wages. Salaries and wages, public sector salaries were not really affected by COVID, but you can see the impact on private sector salaries, and that recovery is still underway. I just saw today the Andrew Levy survey show that collective bargaining agreements have gone up by 6.1% in the last quarter. And Chair, that's worrying because that would suggest that we are we could have further second round effects of the high inflation that we have at the moment, which could prolong the period by which inflation stays high, requiring the central bank to do more to bring it down. Slide 22 showed that consumers are under strain. Consumers are under strain for several reasons. The COVID issues, again, is reflected on the previous slide, but also very high food and fuel prices. I'll say a little bit more about that in a few minutes. But also household wealth has taken a knock as a result of falling equity prices, Chair. And that's inside in the Consumer Confidence Index. We have seen a significant increase in inflation. From November to June, July this year, we've seen inflation increase at a headline level by almost 4 percentage points. Chair, the blue line in that graph shows that while in the midst of COVID, inflation was close to the bottom end of the target, it accelerated quite rapidly. And particularly since the onset of the Ukraine-Russia conflict and its impact on global oil prices and food prices, peaking at 7.4%. Chair, that is largely driven by food and fuel. And again, that's reflected in the next slide. Thanks. That shows food inflation. Food inflation was projected as in, it was projected to stabilize at around 5-6%, but it's gone up towards 8%. And the food inflation drivers are reflected on the right hand side. Chair, Ukraine, Russia produce a significant share of global wheat, but also a significant share of global vegetable oils, and that those two things have pushed up prices. And that's had a knock-on effect on food prices. I think fuel inflation, it's a story that's known. Oil prices were rising before the war. It had increased significantly. It came off a little bit in the first few months of this year, but since the war, it went up again. And we've seen it come down in the last 3 or 4 weeks, partly because the world economy is now concerned about slowing growth. So we've seen oil prices come off the $130 barrel highs towards the $90 to $95 barrel range where it's at the moment. Chair, that should provide some relief at the pump going forward. Our estimate, I see the preliminary figures, is that the September fuel prices may come down by over 2 rand a liter, and that would be positive for both inflation and household incomes. Chair, what we see in the South African inflation data is that you often get an increase in food and fuel inflation, and then core inflation gets pulled up later. We often get asked, why are you hiking interest rates if this is an exogenous shock of food and fuel inflation? Chair, the simple answer is that we're not too worried about rising food and fuel inflation. We know that that's exogenously driven and cyclically driven, but we do try to prevent that from becoming broad-based. And what we have seen is that core inflation has been going up. Several of the core inflation indicators have been going up, and it is our job to worry about the broadening of the base of inflation, and that's why we have acted as a central bank and have acted pretty boldly, we think, to try and minimize the effect of second round effects, Chair. Slide 27 merely shows the annual producer price index graph, very, very high levels. Now, what this means is that producers are having margin squeeze. So they're absorbing some of the costs. They're not passing on all of their cost increases to the consumer, which probably means that at some point they would want to pass on those cost increases, Chair. And again, that is a risk that we've got to manage, that when economic conditions are more favorable, producers may try to pass on price increases to consumers. Again, I think we've made the point on this slide. Let's move to slide 29. Chair, we've worked pretty hard to bring inflation expectations down from the top end of the target range, closer to 6% to around 4.5%. In fact, inflation expectations dipped marginally below the 4.5% range. I'll stop after the slide. I understand that the governor is back on. But Chair, with increased inflation in the last 6 months, inflation expectations have also gone up. We're quite concerned about that. And part of the monetary policy steps that we've taken is certainly to try and bring inflation expectations back towards the mid-end of the range. Chair, on the right-hand side are what's called market-based expectations of inflation. And so even those have gone up. While it's natural that the one-year and the present-year inflation expectations would go up, we are concerned that the 5 and 10 year inflation expectations lines have also gone up. And again, monetary policy action would attempt to try and bring those back down to the 4.5% range, Chair. Governor, we are on, you can take over on slide 30, Governor.
Now finish the economics part, just finish the economics part.
Sure. Just a few more slides on that. When we've got a chain here of rising food and fuel prices, rising core inflation, and that feeds into rising salary increases. And when that happens, then in some ways the horse is bolted, right? Then you've got broad-based inflation, and that's very worrying and very damaging to household and household income. And we're beginning to see signs of that, right? We're beginning to see that wage increases are starting to be pegged slightly above the inflation target range, and that's worrying. We make the point that if productivity gains are not, if salary increases are not compensated for by productivity gains, then that does lead to inflation, and that would require a stronger monetary policy response. I don't think it's on this graph, but again, the latest Andrew Levy survey puts the collective bargaining increases at 6.1, which is above the target range, Chair. Chair, we often asked, why are you increasing interest rates if inflation has peaked already? What we often look at is real rates, right? And that's inflation, the repo rate, less inflation. And what's quite clear is that we still have a very accommodative monetary policy stance. To use a term that the governor has used, when we reduced interest rates during the COVID era to 3.5%, in some ways we put our foot on the accelerator, the economic accelerator. What we've been doing for the last 7 months has largely been taking our foot off the accelerator. Theoretically, it's probably not yet fully off the accelerator. We're probably not yet at what we would consider a neutral rate. Economists differ on what that neutral rate is, but it's probably closer to 7% than the present 5.5% that we're at. Just to re-emphasize that in real terms, our interest rates are still relatively low and relatively accommodative and supportive of the overall economic recovery. Chair, when we publish the monetary policy statement, we publish what's called the QPM, the quarterly projection model implied policy path. And this is a transparency tool that the central bank uses to try and communicate what is likely to be the future interest rate path. We do this because we think it is good policy if economic actors know where inflation or sort of where interest rates are likely to go to. It's not a promise. It's not it is state contingent. But it is a projection for what we think is likely to be the interest rate path. And as that graph on the left points out, we think it's likely to taper off closer to the 7% range. And so we're still in a hiking cycle by those definitions, Chair. And again, the panel on the right merely shows the 3 to 5 quarters ahead average inflation and relative to the midpoint of the target. Chair, to summarize the economic section, that inflation globally has reached crisis levels. In some countries, it is peaking, but there is significant debate about the pace at which it is likely to fall. As monetary policymakers, we want it to fall as quickly as possible to limit the impact that it has on household disposable income. As a result of rising inflation and rising inflationary pressures, advanced economies have increased the pace at which they are increasing interest rates. That has implications for the global economy. Generally, when advanced economies increase interest rates, it results in capital flows towards advanced economies. Generally, it results in a weaker currency and inflation pressures for emerging markets. But also, emerging markets that have borrowed in dollars often are left swimming naked in the port, to use an old expression, when U.S. interest rates are rising and they have got significant dollar debts. Chair, we began increasing interest rates in November this year, and we have been more forceful in recent months to try and manage inflation down. Our projection is that it is likely to peak soon, but we want it to fall as quickly as possible. Domestic GDP growth is still likely to be hampered by structural factors. There are some cyclical factors, but certainly the key structural factors, weak business confidence, a lack of electricity supply, and some of the long-running factors that have contributed towards weak investment performance. Chair, let me stop there and the governor can take over. Governor, do you want me to do the one slide on financial?
No, that's fine. I will take over from here. Thank you very much. So that dealt with the economic development and the macro, the monetary policy stance. We now turn to the issues of financial stability. The South African financial system had remained resilient during the period under review, and there had been no systemic events recorded. But some of the main risks to financial stability that emerged during the year included the continued impact of COVID-19 on growth and the unequal impact on income and employment. Secondly, the impact of rising inflation and global tightening of financial conditions and how they affect the local financial system. The July 21 unrest and its cost to the domestic financial system had become an issue for the financial sector. Then the high level of government debt and the concentrated exposure of the financial sector to the government. What had happened here during COVID was that as foreigners pulled out, the domestic stepped in. So the domestic financial sector continued to pile on government debt as government was trying to fund the deficit. And that had been an issue because it led to concentration, but it also meant that the financial sector couldn't quite lend to the private sector and instead had been lending to government. The issues of risk related to climate continue to become an issue for the financial sector going forward. And lastly, the possible impact of the Russia-Ukraine conflict on financial stability. There are big moves globally that are aimed at stopping financial flows. And this meant that the financial sector began to de-risk and it had introduced issues. On the right side of this slide, we have got what we call a financial stability heat map. When you see red, that means that we are concerned about a build-up of risks. And where it is green, that means that we have got no concerns. And then between the red and the green, there are various colors that we might have. We go through these things through the various indicators that we monitor that varies from the residential real estate market through the commercial one, all the way to the non-bank financial non-financial corporations, basically corporates that borrow from the financial sector and also the borrowing by government. It just captures this thing for you in one picture. Next slide, please. With this, I would like to then turn to the actual annual report and the performance. The key initiatives for the SAP had been around the national payments, the financial technology, and climate change. We had had to deliver on our 2025 strategy, and we will be reporting the progress that we are making with respect to that. We will also talk about what we have been doing on the preferential procurement side. We will also talk about the little corporate social response, social investment that we do, and then we will finish off with some human resources highlights. Next slide, please. The key initiatives with respect to the national payment had been that we have embarked on a renewal of our real-time gross settlement system, which will be under development until 2025. Across the world, central banks are now upgrading their real-time gross settlement system. This real-time gross settlement system is really the backbone of the entire payment system in the country. So the banks and other players, they all settle through the real-time gross settlement system, and so we are upgrading that that system at the moment. We also embarked on a review of the National Payment Systems Act of 1998, which is being led by the National Treasury, and that this review should provide the staff with the necessary powers to regulate, to license, and oversee and supervise payment services. And this is important to modernize our payments legislation to allow newer players to be able to come into the national payment system. The first growing area where central banks are currently focused on has to do with the interaction of finance and technology. And together with central banks from Australia, Malaysia, and Singapore, coordinated by the Bank for International Settlement, the South African Reserve Bank is part of a global project called Project Dunbar, which tested the use of central bank digital currency for international settlements. So there have been talk of creating central bank digital currencies. But most of the work that was being done in respective jurisdictions have to do with looking at the role of the CBDC in specific jurisdictions. And the question is, what if citizens of one country have to trade with citizens of another? So this Project Denver was testing the use of central bank digital currency if it goes across the border. The project has identified challenges of implementing a multi-CBDC platform, which is shared across central banks, and proposes some practical design solutions to address those challenges. On the domestic front, the staff published Project COCA 2 report, which further explored the use of distributed ledger technology. And it had highlighted legal, regulatory, and policy implications when applying DLT in financial markets. Next slide, please. There is the issue of climate change that is also important. And here I have to set the context here and say that we are not the leader in tackling climate change. Our involvement in the work on climate change has to do with what this actually means for the execution of monetary policy and what it actually means for the financial system. So we do play an important role in adapting and mitigating against climate change risk, but is restricted to our primary area of responsibility. The immediate task is to improve information flows within the financial market so that climate change considerations inform investment decisions and maintain financial and price stability. Our work program is guided by the recommendations of the network of central banks and financial regulators called the Network for the Greening of the Financial System and the Financial Stability Board, to which South Africa is participating. And the Financial Stability Board is a component of the group of 20 countries. Locally, the SAP coordinates with the National Treasury and other regulators through the Intergovernmental Sustainable Finance Group. And again, as you could hear from the name, we are confined to our areas of responsibility. Our immediate focus is gaining an understanding of the impact of the transitional and physical risks for monetary and financial sector policy. And secondly, incorporating the disclosure and the taxonomy requirements in the regulatory framework and providing guidance to financial firms on how to incorporate financial risks in their risk management. And thirdly, developing stress testing scenarios that if the climate risks materialize, how resilient will our financial sector be? Would it be able to withstand that? So we develop these scenarios and they are benchmarked against what other central banks around the world are doing. And lastly, that we need to improve the data sources in assessing the risks associated with climate change. Next slide, please. Mr. Jenkins? What progress have we made in terms of the implementation of the strategy? Our strategy is underpins what our primary responsibilities are. And so we have got a primary mandate of price stability. So the first focus for us has to do with price stability, which is to keep inflation within the target and closer to the midpoint of the target range. The second focus area has to do with promoting and maintaining financial stability, which is what we have just talked about with respect to that heat map. And the third focus area has to do with promoting the safety and soundness of the sub-regulated financial institutions and market infrastructures. And as we have learned from COVID, the external resilience of the economy is important. And within our responsibility, we have had to take measures to enhance South Africa's resilience to external shocks. And from the COVID, we deployed our tools in accordance with our mandate to try and smooth the impact of those shocks on the South African economy. And we should say that with respect to our responsibility, with respect to the financial sector, the financial sector came out and showed its resilience, but also importantly, that through our monetary policy stance, we were able to smooth the impact of COVID on households and firms. And lastly, continue to supply quality banknotes and coins. So they are there. This stuff is also captured in our annual report to deliver against this strategic focus areas. There are a number of internal processes that are also spelled out that we call the enablement focus areas that I would not dwell into at this stage. And if members would like to ask any questions with that, we are available. Next slide, please. With respect to this focus area, as I said, strategic focus area one, inflation remains within target during the period under review. Subsequent events after the end of the financial year had shown that inflation had bounced above the target. We actually believe that the average for this year will be 6.5, and that into next year we will be back within the inflation target range. Based on the assessment of the balance of risks that we are having, but there are still risks on the horizon. And with respect to our financial stability responsibility, we continue to monitor the financial system for signs of stress, and we have taken several regulatory interventions promptly, appropriately, and adequately to ensure the continued safety of the financial system. The impact of COVID-19 notwithstanding, the country's financial system remained resilient with no systemic events being recorded. With respect to the safety and soundness of the financial institutions, the Prudential Authority continued its intensive supervision of regulated financial institutions and their adherence to governance and risk management practices. There have been no systemically important financial institutions that failed during the period under review, although certain smaller institutions were placed under specific regulatory action. A capital flow management framework is under development, although its rollout has been impacted by COVID-19. With respect to SFA 4, we continued to improve the monitoring of external vulnerabilities, given the significant impact of COVID-19. And we have been developing and implementing various tools to improve the policy toolkit and enhance the functioning of the financial system. One measure of resilience, of course, is the gross foreign exchange reserves. They rose to 58.2 billion as of the end of March this year, from 53 billion in March 2021. And they do actually build a cushion for us. As the global financial conditions are tightening, and we expect that there would be a repricing of financial assets globally, the expectation is that there will be capital outflows from emerging markets towards the advanced economies, and you need that cushion in reserve to be able to absorb that shock should it materialize. The subsidiaries of the SAP that are producing banknotes and coins have fulfilled their annual orders, although there were disruptions due to COVID-19, and this resulted in an increase in production costs. But banknotes and coins buffer level stocks are sufficient to meet public demand, and there should be no concern about the availability of banknotes and coins. The financial summary of the, that is the next slide, you were right, Mr. Jenkins, of the SAP, we have got four components that we would look at. The first is the cooperation for public deposits, which is the internal to the Reserve Bank and is a subsidiary that takes the deposits on behalf of government and selected public. It had returned to profitability, but it had to do with a repricing or the reversal of the expected credit loss that it it actually was provided for in the previous year. And the fair value loss on the previous year came as a result of the land bank notes of 252 million in 2021 and 167 million reversal in 2022. The land bank called for a moratorium on a certain number of their notes, and accounting wise, we then had to provide for them on our balance sheet. And since it's the CFD that invests, it provided for that. And as we gained more information about the state of land bank finances, part of those losses were written back into the CPD balance sheet as a profit realized. The South African Mint is the subsidiary of the SAP that produces notes and coins. It had reported profits this year of 380 million rand after tax. And the sales, which include Prestige Billion, which is a joint venture with the Rain Refinery, increased by some 300 million rand, which is just 6%. The cost of sales increased by 100 million, which then resulted in the profit that we had seen. There had been an increase in operating expenses, mainly as a result of an onerous contract provision relating to the Thailand export order. The bank notes company is the subsidiary that produces bank notes. This it becomes of interest. It did report profits of 205 million rand after tax, which is an increase from last year of where they made profits of 60 million rand. And then the SAP itself has a loss of 2 billion rand after tax this year. Last year was a profit of 1.5 billion rand after tax. And what has been driving this swing from a profit to a loss, the trend there, you could actually see it had to do with a fair value income, which decreased by 6.2 billion due to increasing yields on FX reserves. So what happens here is that we invest reserves, we invest them at a fixed interest rate. As the interest rates go up, that means that the price of those assets decline, and we have to account for that. So the reserves are still there, but the value attached to them as a result of taking account market development results in a loss. Operating costs have been contained, although they have increased by some 330 million rand. We did receive dividend income of some 786 million rand, and that is as a result of the subsidiaries that are profitable, so they declared the dividends to us. And of course, the tax expense, we have been paying tax throughout this year as a result of the profit. And this year, because the year ended 2022, we had made a loss. The tax expense had decreased by some 1.7 billion rand as we recognize a deferred tax asset. Next slide, please. This is the group statement. We have taken those things as individuals. So we took the subsidiaries and we took the bank itself. If you put all of them together, including our share of profit and net of impairment in African Bank Holding Limited, the net result is that the total group attributable to the parent, then is a loss of 1.7 billion rand. So I had taken you through all the stuff that is under this slide on the previous slide. So this is just the consolidated picture. Next slide, please. Of course, one of the things that comes is the compliance with the preferential procurement and what we have done. BBBE performance had increased from 21.3 points in 2020-2021 to 21.5 points in 2021-2022. This is just a 0.2% increase, which was mainly due to the following. Firstly, a significant improvement in the Black ownership category with a 0.9 point increase, a significant improvement in the emerging micro enterprises category, and it is also noted that the qualifying small enterprises category reduced further from 2.5 points of a possible 3%, 3 points in 2019-2020. The SAF has consistently maintained maximum points for the Black women-owned category since the 2019-2017 financial year, which marks 6 consecutive years of solid performance. Next slide, please. We do have a small component of corporate social investment. The amounts that we spend on corporate social investment are modest, and they are mainly geared to getting our staff involved, and we have decided to narrow our focus on education, and the program works to expand the understanding of monetary policy at high school levels. So we run a monetary policy schools challenge. We also focus on developing human capital in the fields of monetary policy and financial stability. So we sponsor a chair of monetary policy and a chair of financial stability. And we also focus on enhancing the economic and financial journalism. There is a significant deterioration in the quality of journalists. They are getting increasingly old. We have invested on this over a period of time. But we also do support students with funding and provide support to special needs schools. The total CSI budget for the period under review was just 26.8 million rand. It's a modest amount. The underlying philosophy here is that to the extent we make profit, the profits should go to the government, and then government can allocate those profits as part of the resources that government has in accordance with the priorities that government has set. Next slide. Mr. Jenkins? In terms of human resources, we are a knowledge institution, and investment in our people is a very important driver of our execution of strategy. We conducted an employee engagement survey in February 2022 with a workforce participation rate of some 84.7%, which is a slight increase from the previous period of 2020-2021. Overall, the engagement score remains in the platinum seal category, which is the highest category that you could score of 70.6%, although this is a marginal decline from the previous year. The platinum seal is the highest level in the Deloitte Best Company to Work For survey. So we do have a very happy workforce. The bank's total staff composition is 81% Black, meaning Africans, colored, and Indian, and 12% white. The executive management team is 86% Black and 14% white. Top management is 63% Black and 37% white. And senior management is 75% Black and 25% white. The bank spent 68.2 million on training and development, which is 3% of our total payroll. This equates to 2,248 employees, or 98% attending a training intervention in 2021-2022. The coverage ratio of our critical roles, that is the roles that we identify, that we say these are crucial to the functioning of the bank. They are currently occupied by people, but are there people elsewhere in the bank who can fulfill this role should the person occupying the role be knocked by a bus, God forbid, or something happens to them, or they have to go on retirement? And our coverage ratio is a good 90.8% internally, and the target that we had for ourselves was 85%. So we are ahead of to have covered. We can always go and buy that talent elsewhere. We do train people, and we would like to keep them in the sub. And there are people that we identify as talent, and those that we identify as talent, if they leave the sub, we regret it as a regrettable loss. And so we watch a regrettable turnover ratio. We have set our target that the regrettable turnover ratio should be less than 4%. At the moment, we only have a regrettable turnover ratio of 1.6%, which means that we are able to retain the critical skills that we need for the execution of our mandate. I think this is going to close, Mr. Jenkins. Next slide. The staff composition of top management, as you could see from the bar, female representation has increased from 39% in 2020-21 to 43% in 21-2022. Male representation then had to decline. It declined from 61% in the previous year to 57% in the period under review. Next slide, please. At a senior management level, again, female representation has increased from 47% to 51%, and again, showing that we are making progress. And with that happening, it meant that the other categories are then also declining. But of particular importance that one would like to highlight here is that African female representation has increased from 52% in 2020-2021 to 58% in 2021-2022. So very consciously, the execution of our employment equity program is actually yielding results. Next slide, please. And so that is the staff from the bank. I would then, Chair, want to touch on the Prudential Authority, because we submit that report as a supplement to the sub report, and then we can deal with them together, because the Prudential Authority is overseen by the Prudential Committee, which is basically chaired by myself, and it has got the three deputy governors in it, and that is providing the oversight of the Prudential Committee. And underneath is the PA Management Committee, which oversees the general operations and management, as well as the oversight of regulatory and supervisory matters, and is made in the previous year. It's headed by the Deputy Governor. In the period under review, it was Deputy Governor Kube Naidu. It is now Deputy Governor Fundi Chasivana. And they are then assisted by four heads of departments. Next slide, please. Mr. Jenkins. The Prudential Authority has by law to publish a regulatory strategy. And this regulatory strategy runs over a period of 3 years. And the first regulatory strategy was published on the 1st of October 2018, and it was revised and published again on the 1st of October 2021. It sets out the Prudential Authority's approach to regulation and supervision and outlines its key priorities for the next 3 years. These priorities are set for banks, for market infrastructures and insurers, and they include strengthening and enhancing the regulation and supervision across institutions, implementing the financial conglomerate regulatory and supervisory framework, developing an approach for the prudential regulation of medical schemes, pension funds and collective investment schemes and friendly societies, developing cross-sectoral regulatory instruments for harmonizing the requirements across industries, and of course, enhancing anti-money laundering and countering the financing of terrorism supervision and implementation the recommendations from the Financial Action Task Force mutual evaluation. And then also to implement the approach to transformation, financial inclusion, and competition, and the role that the PA plays in accordance with the Financial Sector Regulation Act, but also to support financial innovation and new technologies. And this is done in accordance with what we had set out in the SAP Innovation Hub, where we facilitate and provide the environment for innovators to actually come and test what they are actually setting out to achieve. And then lastly, developing the regulatory and supervisory approaches to sustainable finance and the issues of climate change. And again, here, taking a cue from the international standards that are being set. Next slide, please. The Prudential Authority, after we had the financial sector assessment program, have had to deal with certain recommendations. The financial sector assessment program, its role is to assess the country's likelihood and severity of financial sector crisis. It is conducted by the IMF and the World Bank. And last year, that FSAP for South Africa highlighted the following positives in the report, that the financial system has thus far weathered the shock of COVID-19, that the banks and insurers appear well capitalized and have got ample liquidity, that the financial sector oversight is strong, reflecting a commitment to independent supervision and the implementation of international standards. The FSAP also did make certain recommendations for improvement in our regulatory and supervisory space. Firstly, that we should strengthen our vulnerabilities analysis, which should include further strengthening of analytical tools, that the financial sector oversight, which includes risk-based supervision, early intervention in banks and improved climate risk oversight, amongst the other recommendations. And lastly, systemic liquidity, referring to improving the repurchase market using different mechanisms and processes. So what we're saying about the financial sector in South Africa is not just what our take is. There is an independent international assessment that was done, which has reached these conclusions, and it is something that we look back with pride that we were able to report such a high standard of performance with respect to this. The thing that is very topical at the moment is the implementation of the Financial Action Task Force mutual evaluations, failure of which could result in South Africa being grey-listed. The assessment commenced in 2019 with a final report published on the 7th of October last year. The mutual evaluation report had an adverse rating under technical compliance and effectiveness, and made the following recommendations amongst others. Firstly, that all regulatory authorities should subject beneficial owners to fit and proper test and verify that directors, senior management and business owners or their associates as part of market entry control and supply this standard and apply this standard across
recording in progress.
31 registered banks and local branches of foreign banks, 4 mutual banks, 5 cooperative banks, 24 cooperative financial institutions, 69 life insurers, 70 non-life insurers, 8 reinsurers, and 9 market infrastructures. I just say that the number of mutual banks here still include BBS Mutual Bank, which has not yet been deregistered, and the number of the market infrastructures includes Zarex Limited, whose license was suspended by the FSCA with effect from the 20th of August 2021. Next slide. The Prudential Authority does pay a particular focus on deposit taking financial institutions. They are the most significant part of the sector. South African banking sector is dominated by the 5 largest banks, which collectively hold 89% of the banking sector assets. When we say they are holding banking sector assets, it means that they have lent to the other sectors, and the local branches of international banks only accounted for 5.97% of the total banking sector assets. Next slide, please. And the cooperative sector, as I had said there, in total, 29 institutions. It's not a big sector, but it is very important for financial inclusion, and we do watch that closely. And together with the CBDA, we also assist the cooperative financial institutions as they develop. Next slide. With respect to the insurance sector, I mean, I've spelled out the numbers. The life sector is dominated by 5 largest insurers, which collectively hold 72.7% of the total assets, while the 9 life insurance sector is dominated by the 8 largest insurers, which collectively hold 59.7% of the gross premiums. Next slide, please. We have talked about the enforcement of the regulations that we administer. And during the period under review, the Prudential Authority imposed administrative sanctions, including financial penalties for non-compliance with the Financial Intelligence Center Act 38 of 2001 on the following institutions. They are spelled out there: Deutsche Bank, Discovery Bank, Fed Group, Sanlam Life, and we spell out the penalties that were imposed. Next slide, please. If you are looking for any additional information, this is for additional information. We had, during the period under review, 1 approval. There are 4 applications from banks and mutual banks and cooperatives that are in progress. None had been declined. There is in progress the application of a foreign branch, that is 1. And the cooperatives, 2 approved, there are 4 in progress. And with respect to the insurers, 20 had been approved and 18 are in progress. I must just say, due to a timing issue, the number of insurers approved excludes Sustain Insurance Company Limited, which was licensed during 2020-2021. Financial year period. The rest of the information is therefore information. Next slide is for me to thank you and for your attention, and apologize for that technology glitch. There was a switch of Wi-Fi, and in the process I lost the connection, but I am glad that DG Naidu was able to step in and continue to the presentation. We are now open for questions, Chair. Mr. Jenkins, you can stop sharing.
Okay. Thanks, Governor, and your team for the presentation. Honorable members, that's where we are. Let's engage the presentation. Dr. George, can you start?
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Governor, and others for your presentation. Very interesting and thorough as usual. I just want to ask two questions. You mentioned the external vulnerabilities, obviously, of the economy, and also if we look at this, the bank itself, you did mention that the issue of the FATF now watching very closely at the difficulties that South Africa is facing in managing money laundering, and the UN, I think, recently said that South Africa is a conduit for the funding of terrorism, etc. So these are all issues that have very serious consequences for us if we are grey-listed. Now, we know in the committee that the Treasury is looking at amendments to FICA. But my question to the Reserve Bank is, you obviously look closely at your environment and you are looking at the possibility of grey listing. Now, in the terrible event that we do in fact get grey listed, have you given consideration to what the implications are going to be and how we can mitigate them if possible? Obviously, we know steps are being taken, but hope is not a strategy. So we need to be prepared in the event that something like that does happen. I've been looking closely at what happened to Pakistan, for example, and it's certainly very interesting what the impact was on GDP, etc. So I'd like to know from the bank what it is doing in terms of mitigating risk and, preparing for any possible eventuality. And then the other issue that I want to raise is the issue of the nationalization of the bank. Now, we know this matter has been around for a very long time. My party's position is quite clear that it should not be nationalized. But anyway, there is a lot of noise around that again. So that may well be back on the table. And what I want to know from the Reserve Bank, whether they are considering that as a potential risk to the independence of the bank, or what is it that the bank is doing, given that sort of environment looming? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Governor.
Thank you, Chairperson.
To ask a clarity-seeking question or make a comment. Okay, you can respond to that, Governor, and your team. In the meantime, I will also come. I've got one or two questions that I want to ask. You can respond to Dr. George's questions.
Thank you very much, Honorable George. The external vulnerability is a moving thing. So you never know where the black swan will come from. There are things that we know that as a small open economy that we are vulnerable to. And whenever I meet my colleagues from the other emerging markets, what do we talk about? We always talk about the impact of capital flows inwards or outwards, and what it would mean for the exchange rate and what it would mean for inflation. So if we are a small open economy, that is what you continue to watch. And I will get to the part of listing now, but it is also in that context that you then think of what are the steps that you take to mitigate against those risks. Now, when the risks materialize, they also tend to manifest themselves in the financial sector and then spread to the rest of the economy. And our response and our risk mitigation was to make sure that our financial institutions are resilient, but importantly, that the system itself is actually resilient. And we constantly watch that, and we sometimes ask ourselves whether there is something that we are missing. And we subject the system to stress testing. We work out scenarios that we would say, this is a stress scenario, everything from moderate to the most severe of the scenarios, and test whether the system will be able to withstand that. We did that a couple of times, and we found that the system would be able to withstand that. And we said, maybe we are missing something. Maybe we are missing something. We got two independent institutions to review the stress testing that we had done, and they found it to be consistent with best practice in how to stress a financial system and test for its resilience. That is the one component. The second component is that those shocks could actually lead to the exchange rate depreciating, and that depreciation you normally see through and say that this is just a shock, we will wait for the second round effect. Should the second round effect materialize and inflation begins to rise, you are going to have to respond to that. And as part of the mitigation, starting in 2017, we started to say that the inflation target range is 3 to 6. But it doesn't help to be comfortable just you are just within the 3 to 6, because it doesn't give you degrees of freedom should you be hit by a shock. So we started to emphasize a focus on the midpoint of the inflation target range of 4.5%, so that we have got wiggle room should a shock materialize. The shock did materialize in the form of COVID-19. And the fact that we had kept inflation low and closer to the 4.5% meant that we then could utilize our primary tool, which is the policy rate, to smooth the shock and cushion South African firms and households against the shock. Understandably, it is those who had loans who benefited from that. But that is what we could do given our tools. And we deployed the other tools to enable the financial sector to provide relief to households and firms. And we allowed them to dip into their buffers. So the tools that we have, that we put in place, that should the risk materialize, we would be able to deploy, we were able to deploy in accordance with our mandate. When we come to FATF, and you are absolutely correct, hope is not a strategy. Hope is not a strategy. You can't just live in hope. And so what has been done here? Firstly, from the bank side, we did what was within our powers to deal with. So the recommendations that are applicable to the Reserve Bank and the Prudential Authority, as I said, we set a mechanism in motion, and we believe that by the end of this year, everything that the Prudential Authority has to do as the law stands will be done. We can't vouch for the others, and I know the National Treasury will be coming to this committee with some legislative amendments, but we have got to be able to treat this with agency and demonstrate significant progress so that we could actually prevent the gray listing. Or if should we be gray listed, that we will be able to come off that list within a period of 12 months, which is what happened with Mauritius and with Zimbabwe, and I think there are a number of countries. What are the risks here? Well, our concern here is that it's not just that FATF will impose this on us, but that the other jurisdictions like the European Union, which treat the FATF findings as a minimum, will step up their actions on South African-based institutions. What would this mean? What it would mean is that South African financial institutions and South African borrowers will be subjected to enhanced due diligence by the international financial institutions. And when you have that enhanced due diligence, those entities have to assess and say, is it worth it? In which case, they will increase the cost of borrowing for South Africa to take account of that cost, or they might say it's not worth it, in which case they do not avail resources, in which case then the net result of which will be that we will not have access to some of the capital we would have otherwise had access. So the implications for the economy are massive. The cost of borrowing in this economy will go higher. And as we have also highlighted earlier in the presentation on macro, where we talked about the country risk premium, the country risk premium has gone up. We can't say it's solely because of this, but we think the market might be pricing this in. And when the grey listing takes place, those who didn't think will take place will also increase the premium that they ask of South Africa. So the implications for the economy then is going to come through access to international capital and the cost of accessing that international capital. And I think that it's important that as South Africans, that we treat this with the seriousness that it deserves and prioritize it. And my preference would be that we are able to make the changes across government before the January meeting, so that by the time we get there, we would say these are the changes we have made, and hopefully we would be able to avoid the grey listing, or should we be grey listed, that we would be able to come off the grey listing sooner because we would have shown significant progress. On the nationalization of the Reserve Bank, we have said everything that we had to say as the Reserve Bank. The independence of the Reserve Bank is enshrined in the Constitution. And if the nationalization of the Reserve Bank ends up impeding on the independence of the Reserve Bank, we will have to take appropriate measures within the Constitution and within the law to safeguard the independence of the South African Reserve Bank. Beyond that, Honorable George, we can't help you. We've asked the Minister of Finance that he must deal with these issues, and that as a central bank, that we have said everything that ought to be said about this. Chair, that deals with all the questions that I have so far.
Okay. Thanks, sir. There is a challenge or challenges with the UBank and Itala Bank. I don't think as this leadership currently in Parliament and the Reserve Bank, can we afford again to see a small bank collapsing like what happened to the VBS. The VBS story is something that is very, very painful. I come from Limpopo in the Vembe region. And in the main, VBS is based in Twando, Los Trichardt. Those are towns. Twando is almost 25 or so kilometers from where I stay. I've seen the pain of people who were clients or customers of VBS, literally. Others have even died because of what happened to VBS. It's very, very painful. Under our watch, Governor, I don't think we'll want to see another small bank like UBank, Itala, which is serving a bigger population in KwaZulu-Natal, collapsing. I see that under SFA3, you have got a strong team that deals with monitoring and evaluation of financial institutions. Do we have support systems for these banks? Because it should not just end up with monitoring and evaluating whether they are performing, and if they collapse, let it be so. The participation of blacks in the mainstream of the financial sector is the objective of this government. And as of now, as you have correctly reported, 89.79% of the banks are the five banks, and they are owned by whites. It's a fact. The same applies with the insurance industry. You said 72.7% is belonging to those big insurance companies, and they are white owned. Whether there are few blacks who are in the board or so, but they don't become part of the ownership. So we are very worried about the transformation of the financial sector. It's a matter that we have to take up, and we have raised it with the minister. And as I'm saying, can you comment for either Mr. Naidu, who's the chief executive of the PA, on what are you doing to make sure that the UBank does not collapse, and the same applies with the Itala. And probably at some stage, Governor, I think we'll have to meet these banks with you. Because as I say, I don't want to see another small bank collapsing under our watch. And the future generations will ask a question, what did you do? Because you were in a position of responsibility. It can't be that if you don't comply, we'll just close you. And the next thing, it means the five banks will end up controlling 100% of the financial sector, and we know the consequences. So over to you in regard to the questions that I've asked relating to UBank, Itala Bank, and then how do we deal with the issue of transformation of the financial sector in general to make sure that blacks really participate in this sector. We are not just spectators, and some people are just players there. That kind of an economy is intolerable. Over to you, Governor, and your team.
Thanks. We'll, to deal with that, as I also figure out how to distribute my question, I just want to check if there are any other hands. Other question.
Members, are you there? I don't see any hand in the platform.
Okay. 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 Because it's always useful to take this in a group so that I can figure out and prepare people. Thank you very much, Chair. We are always reluctant to discuss individual financial institutions because it's unfair to discuss them when they are not here, and it might be better if they were here and the conversation is with them. But let me speak in general so that we can deal with this. Our primary responsibility is to the depositors of these institutions. So that VBS ended up collapsing, which is sad. The immediate priority for us was to protect those depositors. Yes, if you had more than 100,000, you lost the balance, but at the very least, you knew you will get the 100,000. As supervisors and as regulators, we regulate the deposit-taking activities of these institutions because our responsibility, the law says we must protect the depositors. And so we do not have a regulatory strategy that says we have got to prevent banks from failing, because we do not have the ability to prevent them from failing. Banks can fail. What we have got to make sure is that if they fail, two things do not happen. They do not take with them the assets of the depositors, meaning that we protect them. The depositors' interest must be protected. And secondly, that they should not take the system down with them. And maybe, Chair, if your indulgence, I will explain to you why I cannot talk about both UBank and Itala, is that they are both under regulatory action at the moment. There is a resolution of UBank that is taking place. We have been able to protect the interests of the depositors of UBank. And as things stand, no depositor in UBank would be losing their money. The depositors have been loyal to UBank. They have stayed with UBank. It is a bank that needed capital. And the resolution that we are busy with is to make sure that someone puts capital there. So with your indulgence, I do not want to take it any further than that. Itala, too, would require capital, and this is owned by the provincial government. When we say an institution requires capital, the owners must put capital. And again, that those conversations between my supervisors and Itala and the KwaZulu-Natal provincial government are taking place. So with your indulgence, I would leave it there and not get into the details so that those conversations can continue and the depositors' interests are protected. And you ask the question, what support we provide? We supervise, we license and we supervise. And we control entry and exit. And so when you start an institution, we have to ensure that you are bringing enough capital into the thing. We cannot provide you support. We cannot give you additional capital because that is not what we do. However, during the supervisory process, we will point out at certain gaps or failings and ask that management, the board, and the shareholders remedy those. And we would ask them to give us a plan and see whether the plan is credible. In all my life, I had seen so many of this, and the story always goes something like this. There is someone just waiting. They are just about to give me capital. If you give us 3 more days or 3 more months, the capital will come, and the capital doesn't come. The important thing about capital is that the depositor's protection is against those, against that capital. So when an institution does not have sufficient capital, we have got to tell them, go back to your shareholders and get additional capital. And that is the kind we deal with. When it comes to the cooperative financial institutions, it's a different ballgame. The configuration is different because you have got the Cooperative Banks Development Agency that assists these cooperatives as they develop. So by the time we supervise them, the development path would have been followed through the CBDA. From a policy perspective, you can't put them together. Because once you develop something, you become really attached to it. And whereas as a supervisor, you have just heard from the report of the FATF, it says that we must step up our supervision to be intensive and intrusive. And so we are not the most ideal people or institution to provide support beyond saying to the institution, you have got the following gaps. You have got to plug them, show us your plan, when are you going to be doing it? But we, if we say to an institution they must raise capital, we can't say to them, if you go there, you will find capital, or if you go there, you'll find capital. We say, you, the shareholder, it's your job to bring the capital, bring the capital. And that is how we we approach it. The participation of blacks in the sector, I want to put this and say that FISRA says that we should deal with the issues of transformation in the sector. What I've heard you talking, because you've talked about ownership, what FISRA does for us is not to talk about ownership. It talks beyond ownership. It talks about broad transformation. And as part of the supervisory process, each institution does tell us what their transformation agenda is, and we ask them how far they are doing with respect to the execution of that agenda. That is the role of the supervisor, is to assess the performance against the plan that had been put in place. And interestingly, Chair, is that recently there have been two reports that have been released, one by the Financial Sector Charter Council, which talks about the state of transformation in the broader financial sector, and one by the Banking Association of South Africa, which talks about the state of transformation in the banking sector. And the two reports, the data differ a little bit, and maybe it might benefit this committee to have the Financial Sector Council and the sector to present to this committee so that the committee could have a more meaningful conversation on the state of transformation of this sector using the data that these institutions themselves have produced. So we monitor transformation to the extent that the institutions have to have a plan and whether how well they are doing in the execution of that plan. DG Naidu, Chasivana, or I don't know if Olaus is here. Any one of you want to add anything on this?
No, thanks, Chair. I think you've made the key points. Chair, the Financial Sector Regulation Act says that the mandate of the Prudential Authority is primarily safety and soundness. It has to, of course, by law, also take into account issues of competition, issues of transformation, issues of financial inclusion. And the annual report actually says in some detail how we take account of all of those mandates. But the primary mandate of the Prudential Authority is safety and soundness, Chair. We do work with other agencies and entities to try and promote financial inclusion, promote the integrity of the system through our work with the FIC, to promote transformation, and to promote competition through our work with the competition authorities, Chair. But again, in law, our primary responsibility is that we're a micro-prudential regulator, Chair. Thanks.
Governor, maybe I can just add one other thing, which is around regulatory action. Just to say that regulatory action is not taken lightly. By the time we take regulatory action, whether it's in the form of curatorship or the form of having a statutory manager in other sectors other than banking, this is something we would do after extensive interaction with the institutions involved. And I think it's important to bear that in mind, that regulatory action is not the first step that we take. Thank you, Governor.
Thanks, DGs. Chair, I don't know, I can't see if there are any other hands.
Yes, I can't see also from my side any other hand. Then we'll have to move to the next item. So next, which is a closure. Thanks very much, Governor, Deputy Governors, and the entire management of the Reserve Bank and the Prudential Authority for presenting the report to Parliament. I think what we are going to do, Teguho and your team there, let's meet UBank and Itala. After all, Itala, as you said, the KwaZulu-Natal government is quite involved. We haven't done that vigorously with VBS and this committee, as a committee of parliament, has a responsibility to play oversight on the financial sector, because we are a finance committee. We can't be a finance committee that does not take keen interest on what is happening in the sector. I will employ on the support team of SCOF to communicate with either the board or the management of UBank, including NUM. I think National Union of Mine Workers is a major player in UBank, to come and appear before this committee. And also the Itala Bank with the MEC, I'm not sure whether it's economic development or finance, whosoever MEC in KwaZulu-Natal, who's responsible for the Itala Bank, should come to this committee and take us through as to what is it that's happening. Because at the end, it's ordinary people who suffer if these banks have got challenges. And those people are the people that have voted us to be here where we are as members of this parliament. So we can't be voted by people, and when they've got challenges, we stay away and leave them to suffer. So the SCOF support team, let's take it upon ourselves to meet these two banks. And as the governor has recommended, that it will be also important that we meet the Financial Sector Charter Council and BASA. I think we'll also have to invite NEDLAC, because NEDLAC and National Treasury have been given the responsibility to host the summit, a follow-up summit on the financial sector transformation. There has been engagement before, and there was also a report that was presented to the NA. So we'll have to make a follow-up in regard to that report as to how far are we. Thanks very much, colleagues, members of this committee, the governor, and the entire team of Reserve Bank, the National Treasury, and the support team of SCOF and other officials of Parliament, PBO, the media and the public. Until we meet again, the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Chair.
Ralu Wawa
Twasuk. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. HR dashboard.